There was a gun that won the West. There was a man among the best, the fastest gun or man alive. A lightning bolt when he drew that Colt 45.
No country in the world has been more closely and persistently associated with guns and the personal possession of guns than the United States. It has long been assumed that America's love affair with firearms dates to their widespread presence and use at the nation's very founding. Historian Michael Belisle has looked into that assumption and come up with some interesting results. Here to talk with Belisle is Talking History's Fred Nielsen.
It's something that most Americans know. In the beginning, there were guns. Guns were a superior technology that enabled colonists to conquer the Indians. Guns, found above virtually every fireplace, were used for hunting, self-defense, murder, and war. Guns won America's independence. But in one of the most acclaimed and controversial recent works of history, Michael Belisle, a professor at Emory University, argues that what most Americans know is simply not true. His book, Arming America, The Origins of a National Gun Culture, has received the Bancroft Prize. Professor Belisle, welcome.
Thank you, Professor Nielsen.
Your book originated with your examination of some early probate records. What did you find in them, or I guess more precisely, what didn't you find in them that you expected to?
Well, I was working on a much more boring topic, which was sort of the economic culture of the frontier in early America, a comparative study. And probate records are wonderful for giving a sense of economic networks, what people actually owned at the time of their death. And it just sort of hit me one day that I'd been looking at thousands of these, and I was not seeing the word gun as often as I had been led to believe, because I'd always grown up in the notion that there was universal gun ownership. That's a phrase you read a lot in early America. So then I went back and tried to be more systematic, actually counting how many of these probate records had guns of some kind in them. And I found, again, it's a question of how much emphasis you want to put on a word, whether it's only or as much as, but only or as much as 15% of the probate records had firearms in them. So that led me to a whole series of other records, military records, militia records, business records, production records, trying to determine just how common guns were in early America.
They turn out to be not very common at all, which raises the question of why more Americans didn't have them in the colonial period and the early American, early national period.
Well, I mean, in a way, that's sort of asking why more Americans today don't own Lamborghinis and Ferraris. Firearms in the, particularly in the 18th century, were very expensive. They were difficult to acquire. There were not gun shops, for instance, in communities as there are today. There were no gun manufacturers in America prior to 1794, when the United States Congress established the National Armory at Springfield. All guns had to be imported. There was no one in the United States who could make a gun lock. So this, of course, drove the prices well up. In addition, of course, these guns were very difficult to use, difficult to maintain. They were inaccurate, with the exception of the rifle, which was a very rare item in colonial America. So there was no necessary reason why someone needed to own a firearm. It was a luxury which was associated with either the military or with the elite.
You make the point, for example, that they weren't even all that effective in hunting. Most Americans were farmers.
Yeah, I mean, first off, we have an image, and I had an image, that everyone who lived in early America would in the afternoon or in the early morning grab their rifle, and they always seem to have a rifle, and go hunting. In fact, that is not the way it worked. Most of these people were farmers, and they were devoted to raising crops for their families. Hunting required that you basically leave the community, and I've read a lot of hunting accounts from the 18th and early 19th century. You had to get away from your community, away from the town, which is still the case if you want to go hunting, and go out into the woods and such. And that would take a lot of time and take you away from your work. Now, there were professional hunters in early America, and most famously, perhaps Ethan Allen was a professional hunter. But they used traps. Traps were much more efficient, and they didn't miss, and you didn't need to reload them, as it were. They were cheaper to use as well, and you could basically stay indoors much of the week and then just go check your traps on a specific day. So that's what professional hunters used.
We have an image also of guns being used in battle to subdue Indians and, of course, to help win the Revolutionary War. Yet your book makes the point over and over again that these weapons were extraordinarily ineffective and inaccurate.
Yeah, it's there was a great debate, of course, in military circles in the 17th and 18th centuries over whether or not they should even load firearms. Most military commanders felt that it was wiser to basically use a musket to fire a single round in order to hopefully frighten the enemy and then charge with bayonets. And the effectiveness of this method was proven at the Battle of Culloden in 1746, at the beginning of the year, against the Scots. And it was employed from that date through, at the very least, the Civil War, up until the Civil War, when the technology changed considerably. So, in fact, in terms of battle in the European and North American context when armies were employed, the gun was not being used in order to necessarily kill the opponent, unless a bayonet was at the end. In terms of frontier warfare, the axe was the favored weapon, or the knife, because this was close-in battle. And it's important to recall that after you fired, even the best-trained soldiers took 60 seconds to reload a musket, which would give an opponent a great deal of time to close in and stab one if they were armed with a knife or slash at you with an axe.
Almost from the very start, the state, British government, later the American national government, seems to have regulated gun ownership and use.
Well, yes. I mean, to them, that seemed obvious. They were conservative in a different way, non-libertarian conservative, these governments, including the colonial governments of America and the first government of the United States. What they feared most, of course, was social disruption. They understood that society was fragile and easily brought down, rendered into chaos by the dissatisfied. So in the case of colonial America, the biggest problem from the point of view of those in power was a slave population. I mean, we have to remember that more than 60% of South Carolina, for instance, was enslaved. So if these people could in any way gain access to firearms, they posed, it was thought, a real threat to social order. But there were others they feared, the Catholics, for instance. The Papists, as they were called, they also threatened to disrupt social order. The foreign-born, the workers in the early 19th century, the first labor unions were forbidden access by many states to firearms. And on occasion, even women, because women were known to shoot their husbands with small guns. And so there were, in the 1840s, there was a sort of spate of local laws forbidding women from carrying small firearms.
Most people, I think, assume that a well-armed and able militia, Minutemen, helped win America's independence. Did it?
Well, I mean, this is certainly open to debate among historians, the degree to which the militia played a positive role in the American Revolution. And it's at the moment, it's sort of a split decision that they were useful as auxiliaries. They were useful to back up the Continental Army. But the general assumption of most military historians of the American Revolution is that the Revolutionary War was won by the Continental Army and our French allies. It is certainly the case, as has been known for many years, that, as was known at the time, by the way, that 85% of the firearms used by American forces, both the Continental Army and the individual militias, came from Europe, from France and the Netherlands, and most of the remaining 15% came from England, captured on the field of battle or a gift of England during the 7 years of French and Indian War.
Given what you've learned about the number, the quantity of firearms in America, given what you've learned about its the militia's role, how should we understand the Second Amendment to the Constitution?
Oh, well, there's a huge debate. I don't know how we should understand it precisely. I mean, this is up to each individual reading the Second Amendment at one level. The Supreme Court has understood it in a certain way in several decisions, which is that the Second Amendment was about regulating the militia. After all, that's how it begins, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It seems to me that most scholars have focused on either the first part of that sentence or the latter part of that sentence, arguing either for a collective right through the state militia or an individual right where it says the right of the people to keep and bear arms. I think in the context in which the Second Amendment was framed, we need to understand the sentence as a whole, which is about the right of reliable citizens, as defined by the states, to hold firearms so they can serve in the militia. After all, you know, the people who were responsible for the passage of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights had lived through the American Revolution, and they knew what a close thing it was, and they knew how dependent the United States was on foreign arms and even foreign armies. After all, again, the French allies played such a key role. So Congress, immediately after passing, approving the Second Amendment, the very next thing they did is they moved to arm the American militia. It was the United States government which from the 1790s through the Civil War supplied the vast majority of arms that were carried by the militia. And it was seen as a federal responsibility under Article 1, Section 8 to arm, train, and organize the militia of the United States.
Yes, that raises an interesting further point. One of the threads of your book, it seems to me, is that the government was often more interested in arming at least some of its citizens than the citizens themselves were in being armed.
That's absolutely true. And I mean, this, to me, this was one of the great surprises. I didn't see this talked about anywhere in the literature over the Second Amendment. You know, people today are fighting over whether they have an individual right to acquire any firearm they want. In the late 18th and most of the 19th century, the debate was over how can we get more guns to the reliable citizens. But you see, there was a real tension here for the American states and for the federal government, which is they wanted the militia to be well-armed. They wanted those people they saw as reliable and as bulwarks of the state to be able to defend the state against possible domestic insurrection. That's what they meant by the security of a free state. They were talking about its internal security. But on the other hand, they didn't want guns to be so readily available that those dangerous classes, the lower orders, the slaves, the free blacks, the Catholics, the foreign-born, could acquire these firearms. So the state laws, as well as the federal laws, tried to walk a balance. And one of the ways they tried to do it, for instance, was requiring that militia arms be stored in secure sites under guard so that they would not be seized, as Gabriel almost did in his rebellion in 1800. He was led a slave uprising. Mm-hmm.
The arming of America, by which I think we mean the arming of the general populace, far beyond what had happened before, seems to have occurred, as you present it, very, very quickly in the mid-19th century in the space of a single generation. What happened to bring that about so suddenly?
Yeah, change does occur often very quickly. You just have to think of your own lifetime and look at how the computer has completely transformed our lives in the last 20 years. I think roughly the same sort of technological and productive change occurred in the years between the late 1840s and the late 1860s. And one way of expressing that is very simple, simple statistic. According to the U.S. Census of Manufacturers in 1800, 11,000 firearms were made in the United States outside of the federal armories. In 1860, that figure had risen to 50,000. 30,000 of those guns were made by Samuel Colt alone, by his company. But in 1865, 1.2 million guns were made just in the northern states of the United States. So there was a production leap in those years, those very few years. And in addition, a technological leap in terms of the quality of firearms, their size, their weight, their accuracy, and also, of course, what comes with increased production, lower prices. In addition, of course, there was the Civil War. The Civil War not only trained the great majority of American men how to use guns, but when the war is over, Congress gave Union veterans the right to take their guns home. So in a single step, they managed to train American men to use guns and then arm them.
Most books, most scholarly books, live very quiet lives.
That's right.
Yours has not, by any stretch of the imagination. It has received both very high praise, but also angry, even vituperative criticism. I wonder what you make of its reception and how you respond to your critics?
Well, I must admit the reception shocked me. I rather thought that my book, as my previous books, would hopefully attract some attention from my fellow scholars. But I thought maybe, actually, those people who are most interested in firearms would be interested, would be even fascinated by what I had uncovered, most particularly the federal efforts to arm individuals prior to the Civil War. But The response, the negative response to my book began, in fact, 10 months before the book even appeared. There was denunciations of what they thought it was going to say. And since that time, I think a lot of criticisms of the book have been based on what people read on the web, rather, unfortunately, than what they read in my book. So, for instance, many places on the web you can find the argument that my book states that America was a gun-free, and I'm quoting one of these statements right now, was a gun-free society prior to the Civil War. And that's utter nonsense. I never say anything even closely approaching that. But if one believes that's what the book is about, then of course one is going to think this is ridiculous and that the person who wrote it is in some way committing a fraud. But since I don't say it, it is not. I don't think it is a fair criticism. In the same way, when my book first appeared, there were many criticisms that I didn't address some primary examples of gun use. For instance, Daniel Morgan was raised many times. And anyone who looks in the index will see there are 6 references to Daniel Morgan covering 8 pages, and that I happen to be, in fact, a great fan of Daniel Morgan as an historical figure, and I devote several pages to discussing why he's important. So I think there's a lot of misinformation that has been put out about this book, which has led people to imagine what it says and therefore to dislike it enormously, and I regret that.
We have very little time left. You do write that America's gun culture is an invented tradition, and that for there to be such a culture, there have to be not only guns, but a conviction that the ownership of guns serves some larger social purpose. In the brief moments we have, what social purpose have guns been seen to have?
Well, I think, again, a lot of this grows out of the Civil War. The Civil War did persuade the majority of Americans that guns were necessary either to secure freedom and preserve the Union, or necessary to in the struggle to preserve one's way of life, as we say down here in the South. I think that is still true. I think that many people feel strongly that their ownership of a firearm is a way of securing American liberty and a way of protecting their way of life.
Professor Belial, thank you so much for talking with us today.
It's been a pleasure, Professor Nielsen.
I've been visiting with Michael Belial, author of Arming America, The Origins of a National Gun Culture.
Dad stands in the corner with the barrel so straight. I look out the window and over the gate. The big fat rabbits are jumping in the grass. Wait till they hear my old shotgun blast. Shotgun boogie, I done saw your track.